On the weekend of March 8th, Thunderbird House at 715 Main Street became the gathering place for First Nations leaders, organizers, and their allies to work out a strategy for resisting the TransCanada Corporation's Energy East pipeline, a project said to be larger than the more famous Keystone XL pipeline that was directed toward the United States. I had a chance to attend on the Saturday and collect interviews with some of the participants. One was high-profile Indigenous activist Clayton Thomas Mueller.
My name is Clayton Thomas Mueller. I'm a Cree man from Pugadawagan First Nation, Treaty 6, and I'm a campaigner with Idle No More and Defenders of the Land. And I also am the co-director of the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. I was born into struggle, you know, urbanized at birth. You know, my mother moved to the city while she was pregnant with me. And, you know, we come from a place in northern Manitoba that was, you know, pretty decimated by mega hydroelectric development as well as large-scale mining. And so, you know, for me, I'm what they call a city Indian or, you know, an urban native. And, you know, I guess growing up in Winnipeg and in various other urban centers across the country, I always had questions, shared questions, I think, that other Native young people ask, which was really about why is it in our own homeland that we're so incredibly impoverished? Why do we represent every negative socioeconomic indicator in the Canadian economy? And I started to look for the answers. So we have a window here where we need to do some organizing and essentially, you know, put a stop to the Energy East and the other half a dozen pipelines, slow down the tar sands expansion, put a stop to other regional neoliberal economic plans like the Pacific Gateway Initiative, the Irving billionaire, the Monty Burns of New Brunswick, the Irving family. We need to put a stop to their plans because they essentially have been brokering a Pacific Northern Gateway Initiative Atlantic style, and that's where we see this whole crackdown on El Zapotec and the resistance to fracking, not just by the Mi'kmaq, but by Acadians and New Brunswickers alike, because the Irving family wants to build superports, truck ports, shipping ports, refinery expansions, railway expansions, highway expansions. You know, we see proposals on the table for, a Nunavut to Panama super free trade corridor cut right through the heart of Turtle Island. All of this is being driven by this insane free market neoliberal economic agenda. And Harper, that's his Bible, and whoever's pulling Harper's strings behind the scenes, that's their Bible, and they are very, these are fanatics about that religion, that capitalism. And this is not your grandfather's capitalism, This is an entirely new beast that could be comparable to the way that, that movie No Country for Old Men tried to describe violence from the generation before to the generation we face today. There's a tremendous pressure on us as Indigenous peoples to lead the movement. And, we've been saying this for many years. And the only difference between, now and 12 years ago is that environmentalists, conservationists, and concerned Canadians alike have no choice but to follow First Nations, because every bread and butter strategy they had before has been stripped away. The National Energy Board now has no power because the PMO can override NEB decisions on major infrastructure projects to determine whether or not they're in the national interest. We see that with the approval of Line 9 and all these other things. And we'll most certainly, I think, see that put to the test with the Gateway, although I suspect NEB will approve that anyway. But the fact of the matter is that we live in a time where Indigenous peoples and the Native rights-based strategic framework have become the only so-called legal framework left, not just for First Nations, but for all Canadians to protect the commons from, the grips of big oil and big mining corporations.
There's something in what you've just said that I wanted to investigate a little bit, because I mean, you're saying that the environmental movement to succeed, my paraphrase, is basically to follow indigenous leadership. And what concerns me is that there are people with kids who are naturally going to be concerned about climate change, right? And I can see where someone can be concerned about climate change and be a total racist, right? And by the same token, seems to me, you know, indigenous peoples who demand, you know, indigenous sovereignty, but they may decide we want to capitalize on this. We want the jobs for our community, and we have a right to exercise our sovereignty as we see fit, not as those environmentalists want us to. So I'm wondering if there are not some hazards in terms of these sorts of distinct motivations. Is that something that you can address? Do you understand my point?
Absolutely, and I think it's an important point to consider. I guess my pushback on it would be that, you know, indigenous peoples are no different than any other member of the five-fingered nation, you know, the human race. You know, we got greedy capitalist pro, you know, oil, you know, red card Republican, or I guess blue card conservative carrying, you know, native people too in our community. And we also have a lot more desperation in our community, socioeconomically speaking. So while many of our political leadership might rather be standing, you know, in the streets, you know, with the protesters, with the sovereigntists, with the land defenders on the front line, they are under pressure to generate revenue. And so they have to make very difficult decisions. And unfortunately, in the majority of our communities, especially in the north, that means, you know, getting in bed with big oil, getting in bed with mining corporations or timber corporations. And, you know, that is a sad state of affairs. And I think that that actually hits the nail right on the head, though, in terms of how, you know, this whole moment that we're living in, this epic battle against the tar sands is really, you know, the defining moment in our time that is intimately connected to the reconciliation of this country. Because it's funny, you know, indigenous peoples have all the expectations placed on them that they all got to get along, that they can't have division in their community. You know, consistently, you know, even the term Indian, you know, pan-aboriginalizes us. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I'm no the same as somebody from, say, the Wet'suwet'en Nation in British Columbia, you know, me being a Cree man, as a Chinese person is to a Polish person. Fundamentally different. I mean, sure, we all have a connection to Mother Earth and we're brown, but our languages, you know, our social structures, very, very different. You know, there's extreme diversity there. But within that diversity, you know, you know, one thing that is, like I said, going back to the beginning here, is that red or white, you know, if you are working with big oil companies and you are trying to expand the fossil fuel regime to hardwire Canada and the rest of the world into another century of dirty energy, well, then you've made your choice. And you should expect resistance. And I think a good example of that, you know, is former National Chief Phil Fontaine, you know, who was disrupted while trying to give a speech at the University of Winnipeg. And it divided our community.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I was at that event when it happened, and it was hard for me as someone who doesn't identify as Indigenous to this territory to take sides. I felt kind of like I came into the middle of a family argument or something. There was some very strong criticism of the disruption, and then there were people defending the disruptors. So, yeah, I'm wondering if your own thoughts about that whole situation and situations like it.
Well, it's difficult because Phil Fontaine is a hero, you know. He's a residential school survivor who, you know, facilitated the federal apology, and, you know, and that deserves to be honored. But, you know, in his latter years of his career, he's chosen to work with one of the most notorious homicidal corporations on the planet, TransCanada Pipeline Corporation. And this is not a new thing. You know, we ran into former National Chief Phil Fontaine at a tribal consultation on the Keystone XL pipeline. He was there with the U.S. State Department representing TransCanada Pipeline years ago in Washington, D.C. And now, you know, it's months ago, it was on the front page of the Globe and Mail that he's doing the consultation on the Energy East pipeline. And, you know, he's been busy. 55, according to TCP, 55 of the 155 First Nations and Métis communities that need to be consulted from Alberta to New Brunswick have already signed letters of accommodation. You know, and the fact of the matter is when his presentation at the U of W got shut down by Native women who were there to protect water, to, you know, follow their original instructions and to protect the rights of Mother Earth as well as the future of their children and their children's access to clean air, earth, and water. Our newly emerged Indian middle class took sides with Phil, and it created a schism. And that's one of the reasons why we asked Idle No More Winnipeg to host this national grassroots gathering on Energy East here in the Thunderbird House on Higgins and Main. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, I've challenged the former National Chief Phil Fontaine to have a televised dialogue, you know, on economic development in an Indian country in the era of climate change. And, you know, I have heard through some unofficial channels that he's considering it. So I hope he does. Because the reality of it is that we have many individuals that have benefited from the current economic paradigm. But trickle-down economics don't work in Indian country. And, you know, whether it's Phil Fontaine or Chief Jim Boucher of Fort McKay Cree Nation, who's his best friend, you know, these guys are both working for big oil, and trying to, you know, trying to push a form of economic development that quite frankly is scientifically going to absolutely wreak havoc on Mother Earth's climate, on the local ecology in Northern Alberta, on riparian systems, river systems, and lakes all across the continent. You know, for, like I said, 100 years, more of dirty energy. Right now, what we have is the opportunity to not only support First Nations on the front line, but to really make a statement about reconciliation, about Canada's violent colonial history, and to really let Native people, and in particular, you know, Native women, you know, it's International Women's Day, to let, you know, to recognize and to resource out, you know, our Indigenous social movement. Because, you know, we have other excellent strategies that are emerging, like, for example, the carbon bubble strategy. But there's no political will behind that. You know, Obama's not going to pass a climate bill. And if he does, it, you know, I don't know. I'm skeptical. And maybe his predecessor will. Who knows? Canada has made it clear that, you know, they're waiting for America to do it. And, you know, I'm skeptical if Canada would do it, even if America did do it. And Harper's working very quickly, you know, to sign bilateral free trade agreements with every major economy on the planet. And, you know, and he's working to build pipelines to any shoreline of North America that he can possibly get a pipeline to. So we've got a lot on our plate, but, you know, these are intense times, not just in North America, but across the planet. And, you know, 10,000 people marching in the streets in the peak of Idle No More last year has given me tremendous hope that the rest of Canada will join us in the streets in the months and years to come.
I was wondering if there's maybe one more point. I mean, you just talked about these popular mobilizations. What is there any other experience, or maybe even a story you've heard that gives you optimism about the success of this movement?
Well, you know, it comes down to, I think this resurgence of First Nation and Native American women's leadership and Indigenous women's leadership across the planet represents an assertion of the sacred feminine creative principle back into our politics, our economics, our social systems, and even our spiritual systems. Here you hear the women's drum group of Winnipeg on the big drum, you know, and that you won't see that anywhere else. But I believe that Native people are not stuck in time. You know, we're not some page on a book, a history book. In our culture, our ceremonies, they evolve. And this massive response and of just leadership coming from prominent Indigenous women and being passed on through mentorship, you know, is a direct challenge to the patriarchal power that has been dominating our body of politics for 200 years and that has almost destroyed our ability as human beings to survive on this planet. And so it's time that we listen to that voice and that we do what we can to work and plan for the future from a place of creation instead of a place of dominance and control and destruction. And I think that that's probably the main thing that has been keeping me going, you know, as an organizer, as a father, as a husband, you know, as a comrade, in today's movement, is the leadership of our Indigenous women and the incredible strength and resiliency that they have.